It's not about immigration enforcement so much as reinforcing the idea that crime looks a certain way. That crime has a color. That crime has countries of origin.
Uno, dos, tres!
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, and this is In the Thick. What up?
Hey, this is Julio Ricardo Varela, and this is In the Thick. What's up?
So, dear listener, we are going to bring you part two of our live recordings that we did in Chicago at DePaul University. The three recordings really looking at Latinos, mass incarceration, immigration, intersectionality.
Right.
You know, just the kind of heavy duty stuff we do here on In the Thick.
Right. And we've already dropped, that's how they say it in the podcast world, dropped part one.
Everybody's listening to this. They know about the podcast world, Julio, really.
Which was the Suave story. And he comes back in the second recording at DePaul as part of the panel.
Right. And we were talking about Latino incarceration during the Trump era. Difficult stuff.
Mm. So here it is.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick. We're doing a live recording here at DePaul University. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And today we are going to be talking about a really important subject here in front of our fabulous live audience right here in Chicago. And we are joined for this conversation about Latino incarceration in the Trump era by Roque Planas. He's a national reporter for Huffington Post. Hey, Roque.
Hello.
And Aisha David. She's a civil rights attorney here in Chicago. Welcome, Aisha.
Hello.
And joining us again, Luis Suave Gonzalez. He's a prison reform activist who served over 30 years in prison. Welcome back, Suave.
Welcome back, mi gente.
All right.
Thanks for joining us. Let's give it up.
All right. So we're going to frame our conversation with some context. Based on the Prison Policies 2018 report, there are 2.3 million people locked up in the United States today. Our country has more people detained pre-trial. So this means people that are being held who have still not been found guilty. We have more people detained pre-trial than most countries have in their prisons and jails combined.
Right.
One in five people are locked up in this country for drug offenses, and over 4,000 federal prisoners remain incarcerated under what we know now are outdated drug laws, according to the Brennan Center in NYU. We're going to talk about spending. Each year, $8.4 billion are funneled federally for prisons. Now, add to all of this, mass incarceration is often talked about in the context of something that is very true, but it is a white Black binary that essentially leaves out Latino communities, immigrant communities, brown communities. While Latinos make up 16% of the U.S. population, they're actually 19% of the country's prison population. So, Roque, we're going to start with you. You kind of have a broader perspective. Why do you think that Latinos are consistently left out of the conversation around mass incarceration?
There's one element, right, which is that we're still getting used to the fact that we are an increasingly Latino country. But I think also people have sort of certain ideas about what crime is and may not have a good idea about how targeted Latinos are by the criminal justice system, and particularly at the federal level. At the federal level, well over half of annual criminal convictions are of Latinos.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Let's just sit with that. Well over half.
Yep.
And this is because over the last 20 years, the Departments of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice have teamed up to increasingly prosecute immigration crimes that would be dealt with by our civil enforcement system regardless. Even though just the act of living in the United States is a civil offense, crossing the border illegally is technically a criminal offense punishable by up to 6 months in jail.
But it's a misdemeanor.
It's a misdemeanor. And a reentry case, which can be prosecuted in any one of the 94 federal districts, and is in practically all of them, all you need to prove a reentry conviction is just that the person had been deported in the past. It's an open and shut case that carries with it a sentence of between 6 months and 20 years, depending on criminal history.
So it begins to feel like Latinos and Latinas are basically, because they're now, immigration is now being seen as a criminal offense, it's like we're the ones who are propping up a real big pillar of mass incarceration.
Right, but I think sometimes immigration also
overlooks the other convictions, because I do think the outdated drug laws and other things that play into it. And I think to try to look at this from a macro level. So what's being missed in this conversation? Because I think that's part of the problem, is that we instantly go to immigration and kind of forget that there's federal, there's state, there's city. You know, we have Suave here.
And on top of that, immigration.
Exactly. So Aisha, just give us your thoughts.
Right, exactly. It's a combination of a lot of different types of criminal targeting, is what I'd like to call it. When you're talking about communities of color that are oftentimes over-policed, it means that you are going to be specifically seen and targeted just by where you live and how you look. So on top of the whole immigration conversation, we have to think about the fact that there are Latino communities that are heavily policed, where any instance of quote-unquote suspicion means that you immediately get targeted. And that's one way to think about how big these numbers are. So there's a lot of discretion when the police decide who they're going to talk to, who they're going to try to arrest. When that discretion is allowed to just be, you know, rampantly targeted at people of color, meaning, and I say people of color, but it's mostly Black and Latino people when we say this, it's an option for police to really allow the racism that is in our country and weave throughout society to be presented and used to kind of force people into the system that we already know is unjust. So it means that there are these multiple avenues that you have to consider when you're talking about Latino people being pushed into this mass incarceration system. So on top of immigration, you have these drug issues, you have stop and frisk issues, you have driving while Latino issues. Like, you have the fact that in our country, we have a vice president who is talking and being so lovingly speaking about, like, a person who was found guilty.
Mike Pence, Joe Arpaio.
I don't want to put these names out there. I hate speaking people's names.
Well, I'll do that.
You're not going to speak the names.
That's like hardcore. I like but that.
I treat them like Voldemort, you know? I just don't like speak Voldemort. Their names. So,
but you are talking about Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was running tent cities in our country, just so to be clear. I went... And these were, you know, you have the image of a concentration camp in Nazi Germany of these tents out in the cold and people. This is the same thing. There were tents in 130 degree heat, and they were all being held in outfits that are the prison outfits, you know, the striped outfits. And they were forced to wear pink underwear and pink socks, all of them. And this man is being applauded.
And he's running for Senate.
Found guilty. Applauded by Vice President
by
Pence.
Voldemort, according to Aisha.
Found guilty and then pardoned, because we can't overlook the fact that this person was pardoned by the president. Like, it's an issue that it goes beyond just talking about mass incarceration. It goes into the conversation about why certain people are targeted and picked, pretty much handpicked.
I just think that there's a point of data that's important, because I hear what you said, Julio, about we can't immediately talk about immigration, but at the same time, when we're talking about the prison industrial complex, we can't leave out the ICE industrial complex. More money is spent on immigration, detention, deportation, and enforcement now than all federal law enforcement agencies combined. So that means that more money is being spent to track down, detain, house, and then deport immigrants than the FBI, the Department of Justice police, the ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, the court officers, then all of their budgets combined.
Right. I just wanted to follow up with Roque about what Aisha's saying. Like, you as a national reporter, like, what do you think of that?
All of that ICE detention money that we're talking about does not include the 70,000 people who were locked up by the U.S. Marshals at the end of 2017 for petty immigration violations, at a rough cost of $1 billion annually. It's not about immigration enforcement so much as reinforcing the idea that crime looks a certain way.
Exactly.
That crime has a color. That crime has countries of origin. But think about the year that immigration prosecutions overtook everything else in the federal docket was 2008. And if you look at the sweep of crime that was going on in 2008, that was the year of the financial crisis, driven by fraudulent behavior at the highest level of our banking and financial system, for which only one banker was prosecuted and jailed, and he was a middling guy at that, right? So it's not just who are we targeting with our federal criminal justice system and our resources, but who are we not targeting? How is it that people that committed the crime of the century were not punished, Whereas someone who crosses the border to get a job or reunite with family is prosecuted to the tune of 90,000 cases a year.
What does that mean?
I just
want to point out that we are naming these things. I do not want to be silent in 2018 and having these facts without saying this is what it looks like in the United States today.
Yeah.
And
so
it's sad.
Let's turn to Suave here to recap, Suave, you spent over 3 decades of your life in prison. And if it weren't for the 2012 Supreme Court decision that found automatic life without parole sentences for juveniles unconstitutional, you'd still be locked up.
The numbers are there, but the reality is that in Pennsylvania, if you are Latino, you are considered black. So...
Wait, what?
I could show you my traveling pass right now.
And because you're still on parole.
Even on parole. It don't say a Hispanic man. It don't say Puerto Rican. It say a black.
I don't understand.
Me either, but it's there. Right? But and that was one of the issues that when I was in graduate school prison, I took in the early 90s. Which was Latinos was coming in and you was either black or white. If you look white, you was white. If you look black and you was Puerto Rican, you was black. And they're still doing it. So we decided to put a lawsuit in and we settled with the jail where when you come into the prison system now, it's either black, white, Hispanic, or others. Even now you have white people, no disrespect to nobody here, calling themselves brothers. Because being white in the prison system is almost like being a target. That's the reality. So, oh, now I'm black. So you looking at these guys like, how the heck you black? If you black, then what am I, right? But that's the way the system is made up.
That's some crazy stuff right there.
No, but it's happening.
Aisha, what do you think about that?
It needs to be fixed. And it also, in that fixing, we have to recognize that there are, within the Latino community, there are people who look different. And so if someone who is racist is walking down the street and they see a person who is Latino but looks my complexion, I mean, the people on the radio who can't see me, I am black, they could see someone my complexion who is Latino and think, oh, you're black, and just go from there. And the fact that black people are profiled and Latino people are profiled, it means it doesn't matter whether anyone recognizes that you're Latino or not. It just means that you're dark enough to be seen as someone who can be targeted and treated a certain way.
Dark enough,
yeah.
Suave, I was actually going to ask you this particular moment that happened in one of the hundreds of phone calls that you made to me when you were inside Greaterford Prison serving a life sentence. This was actually the first time that you ever became emotional on a call. It was actually here at DePaul University in one of my classes when you were calling in to speak to my students from prison. And we were talking about that there was a dynamic around Latinos coming in. So what did you say to me and what was that dynamic? And why did you have that? You broke down in tears.
A lot of them guys can't get visits from their families because their families don't want to come into the jail because they're scared of being deported. So these guys don't have money on their books because family don't write, because if I write you, the prison system write your address down, we could go get you. So they don't receive no mail, no money from the outside
world.
So they got to survive. So what the guards was doing, they was taking these brothers and giving them these crazy jobs. If you clean these cells, we give you an extra tray of food. If you sweep the block, now be mindful, I'm on a block that's 2 football fields long, 500 people, 500 cells. And these guys are cleaning the block. And I used to stand in my door and just curse the guards out and like, nah, we got to stop this. So what I did, I used to take my money, go to the commissary, buy all this commissary and tell the guys, put that broom down. You ain't got to do that shit. Because that shit used to irk me. Mm. The guards would tell you, they're the new blacks. They do the jobs the blacks don't want to do in the jail. Because if you take me to do that same job, you're going to have to pay me 42 cents an hour. And even though 42 cents don't sound like much, it's a lot of money in the prison system.
So basically they were like,
it was like slave, plain and simple. The guards tell you, they're the new slaves. Look at them. They sweep the whole block for a tray of food.
Did they actually say that?
Yes. You got to remember, I'm in a prison 45 minutes from Philadelphia, where most of these guards don't have no education at all.
When we look at the history of colonialization, slavery, the war on drugs, how it's really created this sense of mass incarceration and systemic prejudice against Latinos. And you just gave a very clear example of what happened in Pennsylvania. And on top of all this, we talk about the geography of Latino incarceration. You know, despite being incarcerated two times more than whites, prisons are disproportionately located in non-Latino areas. So it's sort of this reverse prison gerrymandering effect in the fact that the prison staff is not generally Latino. Even dealing with, like, the complexities of Latinidad, wouldn't that impact how Latino prisoners are viewed and their families are, like...
As we know, the way in which immigrants are referred to by many people in this country, that we, a term we never, ever, 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 ever use on this show, but in this moment, to refer to human beings as illegal. So if you add that onto all of the data...
The data that I said is basically what Suave just said in his Pennsylvania prison, what how guards treat people.
So if you have a majority white staff and they're looking, you know, because they've been told that these people are illegal on top of everything else, then what does that look like? What do you see in Texas? You're in Austin, am I right?
When, how are people viewing it in Texas or in general? Just anything that you see.
What can I say? I mean, I see like entire privatized constructions being built to house Latinos exclusively. I see it as a system that is based on, like, that is extremely punitive. And I see that the American public has a very hard time understanding how to do anything that will help raise people up and be productive rather than just simply punishing people and parking them in prisons.
Also, Roque lives not far from the Haro detention facility. And some of you may be like, what is Haro detention facility? And Haro actually has been holding on and off women and children, immigrants, as if they are criminal when they are immigrants. So you are within a part of the country where this is very contentious. Aisha, when you talk about over-policing, though, can you just kind of go down a list for us of what over-policing in Latino communities, which are oftentimes Black communities, but specifically, what does that look like? And I'm wondering whether or not the young people in the audience are going to be going like, mm-hmm, yep, check, yep, seen that, seen that, seen that.
Because we are in Chicago, I'll make it very Chicago-specific and kind of walk you through a step-by-step of how terrible these things are and how these policies play out, right? So everyone in this room knows where Pilsen is, right?
18th Street.
Okay. We also know that Pilsen is an area that is very quickly being gentrified, right? We know that with gentrification and more white people moving into the area, there are more police in the area. There are also more restaurants, quote-unquote resources, things that were not seen as being important to try to put in these communities before there was this interest by white people, right? So when you add all of these police into an area that is still very much a Latino community, it means that anyone walking down the street is more easily targeted, right? So then let's say that someone is walking down the street who looks... I'm putting in parentheses, looks Latino. They can be stopped, even though a person across the street who's walking on the street is white, right? Let's say both the white person and the Latino person have a little bit of weed on them, because weed is something that is a lot less contentious now that it's becoming legal in white states. The Latino person gets stopped. They're found with something on them. They get arrested. They're taken to the Cook County Jail, right? At that jail, depending on who you are, you'll be asked to sign in when you go and see someone. So adding all of these things up, adding in the harsher sentences, adding in the fact that these prisons and jails are located away from your family, away from people who want to see you, and they make it so that those people don't want to see you anyway, it means you're being isolated. You're being targeted. And when you leave and when you're out, it means that it takes a lot more to like reconnect with your community. It takes a lot more to feel like you are no longer being targeted, because a lot of times you are still being targeted. So it's like walking around with this target on you your entire life based on something you had no control over, based on something that you cannot change.
I want her to be my lawyer. Just want to say, Aisha, I want to retain Aisha.
So Suave, can you just describe for us everything that Aisha broke down, and then you add on top of that, that within the prison experience, Latinos are seen now as quote unquote an illegal people. What does that look like on the day to day?
Most of these prisons are being built because Latinos and blacks. We are a hot commodity for these white communities where these prisons are being built. And PA, the prisons are being built in communities that has no jobs. The prison is the only job that's providing that community, fueling that community. So now you got a bunch of white people that had no interaction with Latinos or blacks going in there playing Superman. They playing God, like they say. And what I tell Latinos is, how do we change that?
Mm.
We change that by not going to jail.
Well, wait a second, Swabi, because I'm looking at Aisha and I'm like, wait a second. Aisha just basically said, you're just walking down the street.
No, but I'm not done yet. I'm not done yet. Uh-huh. Now, what I see in PA, because I'm in PA, if you are a Mexican, you're going to get stopped. You might have a joint, like she said. But if you are Mexican, we're going to give you a charge, possession. Now you're in the county jail waiting to go to trial. So now the judge won't give you 18 months. Why? Because we're going to get that state money out of you. You see it every day. Now you end up in gratis for 18 months. And after them 18 months, we're going to hold you over for immigration, which is down the block, Lancaster County, to come pick you up. So now one joint got you in jail for almost 2-3 years.
And detained.
Like, and detained.
Yeah. This is what
one
they
joint
do.
That the average person get to walk away on it. So why do it state first? Because we want that money. We want that $45,000, $60,000 that you're worth. It's all about money.
Because you just said these prisons are located in communities
where
there's no
jobs. These prisons are located in counties that need us. When are we going to understand they need us more than we need them?
Mm. Yeah. So this is a fascinating, because this is the part where it's really hard to have this conversation because there's so many complexities. I'm going to direct it to Roque because I know you've done some reporting on this. But what you've seen this change under Trump, and specifically reporting on the Department of Justice prioritization of certain crimes, what have you uncovered and how have criminal justice policies changed under this Trump administration?
Well, basically, just for a long time, the Department of Justice has been like the second coming of ICE. Like they are doing work that is completely...
Whoa, wait, say that again?
That for a long time, Department of Justice is basically the second coming of ICE. Or the Border Patrol, but they're basically...
The second coming of ICE.
And they're in charge of all incarceration.
The Department of Justice led under Jefferson Sessions, who has made it one of his top 5 priorities to actually go after undocumented immigrants of every sort.
But let's be clear about this, though. That began under George W. Bush and was institutionalized and peaked under Obama. Now, the Trump administration is aiming to beat the peak, despite the fact we're at the lowest level of illegal crossings since 71. But that's something that's been an institutional problem that, you know, I mean, I think it's like one of the puzzles that a lot of people have with the Obama administration is like how he allowed all these policies to proliferate. All this would have taken was one, you know, directive from the White House to say, prioritize other crimes, right? But I mean, on my way here, I got an email from the Justice Department with a press release that they just hired 35 new assistant U.S. attorneys to help prosecute the pettiest of the petty immigration crimes in the 5 districts that touch the U.S.-Mexico border. Illegal entry of people who were caught crossing for the first time. In a lot of places, this is like a sentence of 1 to 5 days. It's quite literally just doing it because they can.
A lot of times when we talk about issues of prison reform, they feel overwhelming. I like to point out Suave's case as one of the reasons why tackling prison reform is actually possible, right? Because Suave would have been in prison for his whole life had it not been for the slow wheels of justice ending up at the Supreme Court deciding that incarcerating juveniles to life without the possibility of parole was unconstitutional or inhuman. But there is a question, like when we are talking about, you know, billions of billions of dollars, structurally, how do we even attempt prison reform? Aisha, you're on the front lines.
Like, we're out for us.
We're depending on Aisha, but just asking that question, like, how do we deal with prison? And Aisha was like,
no pressure. Sorry.
Let's leave our audience and the students in our audience with the possibility of hope.
Prison reform is going to be a long and difficult battle, right? It's something that's been longstanding already. It's something that's going to take a long time to actually get done, especially with the input of capitalism and the fact that it is something that does create a lot of money. So I would say my first tip is to don't call the cops if you don't need to, right? I feel like I'm speaking to the, I'm preaching to the choir right now because I saw a lot of faces who were like, yeah, duh. I feel that.
But I think it's hard for people to hear, right?
Yeah.
When we're saying to be safe, do not call the police.
And I won't say that and leave it there. I say that and I followed up with talk to people in your community. You know, have conversations with people, get to know your neighbors a little bit better. I think we're a lot more isolated now, but figure out ways to help deal with issues without involving the police, because a lot of times all that does is escalate situations. I especially stress that if you know that someone is dealing with a mental health issue, because there are countless instances of people who are murdered because they are just going through something at that time and people thought calling the police was the best idea, right? So that's one thing, don't call the cops. The other thing is, if you know someone who's going through the criminal justice system at any point, try your best to stay in touch with them, because there is a lot of dehumanizing behavior that happens to people. And I don't think that I can stress enough how helpful it is and beneficial it is to keep in touch with people. And then when people are out of that system, don't hold that on them. Like, do not reinforce the dehumanization that happened to them. Find ways to help out with reintroduction programs. If you know people who own businesses, encourage them to hire people who may have records. Those are all things that we can do to help keep people from being targeted again. And then if you are interested in becoming an attorney, if you want to do work on prison reform that includes taking cases that might seem like losers, and that means arguing for conditions cases where you have people who are saying, I've been in prison for X number of years and the windows have already been, always been broken. We live in Chicago. It will be negative 30 degrees for a solid month. Can you imagine living under a breezy, drafty window with negative 30 degrees blowing in on you? Like, those are things we're dealing with. All of these things might seem very small when we're talking about this huge issue. Like you said, it's overwhelming to think about it, but it's those little things that we have to really figure out how to fix and address and really break it down piece by piece.
Roque, any thoughts about first steps on prison reform?
I wish I could have a more hopeful view. I mean, everything that you said to me sounds great. I think it's really sad to hear an attorney say, think twice before calling the police, because it says a lot about the level of trust that our institutions have inspired. Man, what do I know? Start letting more people out. I've been convicted on these things that are basically legal now. Just seems like the system is designed to basically criminalize certain groups of people and to criminalize poverty. And it seems like it's a really easy step to just move away from, at least just not prosecuting those cases.
Yeah.
I kind of like what Rocky said. Just, can you let him out?
Yeah, that's why he works for the HuffPost. They're very, like, to the point, make it happen.
Suave.
Before I got out, they was trying to hold marijuana charge that I had in prison against me. This was like 29 years ago. Wow. And they was telling me, we're not going to let you go because you had this charge. And they gave me 6 months to a year.
You got caught with smoking pot once you were first in the prison the very first year.
It wasn't even a whole joint. The guy burned me. It was half.
Damn, that's just a half a joint.
Yes. But they was telling me they put a detainer on me. And they're telling me, you can't go home on this life sentence that the Supreme Court said you could go home because you got caught smoking a half a joint 29 years ago.
Damn.
So
seriously?
That's very real.
That's happening right now outside in DePaul. I'm sorry.
Need to do to reform the system, the citizens. We need to vote. And PA and Philadelphia, we've seen that today. We have a district attorney that's radical. And he got in office with the promise that he was going to reform the system. And he visited the prisons before he became district attorney. He was a lawyer. He helped a lot of guys in that prison. We mobilized our family from the prison, 51,000 prisoners. Go vote for this man because this man is going to reform the system. Mm. I'm not talking about eliminating it because we do need prisons. Some people need to be in prison. Let me say that. I do need the cops sometimes, but vote people that's going to make the change. And if they don't do what they say they're going to do, vote them out. You have that power. Hold them people to the fire. That's how we change the system.
All right.
All right. Going to open it up to our live audience.
Hi, I'm Lourdes. I wanted to push back a little bit on something Suave said about our need for prisons and the police. And we know there's a movement to abolish prisons and to abolish the police. And given the links that you all have drawn between prisons and corruption and the profit motive, well, shouldn't we all be arguing for the abolition of prisons and the police? Mm.
I say that because I've been around for most of my life. People that, if you ask me, I'm not letting you out of prison. Because it's a different when you're in the street game, and it's a different when you're a citizen. So as a regular citizen, what are you going to do when little Swab break into your house, violate to your family? What are you going to do? Is you going to call the cops, or you going to let me get away because you don't think little Swab belong in prison? Now, that's something you have to answer, right?
The third way maybe is community accountability, and we start doing that work of protecting ourselves and taking care of our communities.
It's possible, but the reality is that in North Philadelphia, that's not going to happen. It's not happening right now.
So I've had a lot of clients, and I know a lot of different people who have had different interactions with the criminal justice system, and I have yet to personally meet one person who I think wants to be a criminal, right? I think that there are a lot of reasons why people turn to things that are labeled as crimes. I don't necessarily think that it's because of an inherent issue with that person, like a morality issue or an ethical issue. I think a lot of times it's a question of access to resources. And when I say resources, I mean jobs that pay a living wage, care if you have an addiction issue. If we have a country that prioritizes paying people enough so that they don't have to worry about that, then I think that we'll see a reduction in those issues. If you have a country that prioritizes mental health care, I think you'll see a reduction in some of those issues. And if you have a country that stops looking at people as illegal, looking at people as just the color of their skin, looking at people as targets, as dollar signs for a system that will pretty much just chew you up and spit you out and wait for you to come back through the door, then I think we get rid of a lot of these issues. So I think that there is a pathway to prison abolition. I don't think that that's going to be like a quick switch, right? You have to put these resources in place before you decide to try to abolish prisons.
A round of applause for Aisha David, who's a civil rights attorney in Chicago. A round of applause for Roque Planas, national reporter for Huffington Post. And a round of applause for Suave Gonzalez, who is now a prison reform activist. Gracias.
Thank you.
Dude, I think we got some all-stars like from that recording. What do you think?
Aisha Davis, number one draft pick right now. You know, the part where she said, like, don't call the police was like, I just saw the audience just transfixed on that part. She's just so eloquent.
And also that moment when Lourdes Torres basically pushes back against Suave, you know, who's been in. Just got out after serving 31 years of a life sentence.
I know.
I think, honestly, for Suave, it was kind of a moment to be taken really seriously, to be on stage, you know, with a lawyer and an acclaimed journalist. And I think that he's going through his own process of kind of, again, adjusting to the way people on the outside have been talking about mass incarceration that I think in some ways intersects with people on the inside having the conversation. But he was very moved. He was very, very moved. For him and for me, it felt kind of like a miracle.
Yeah.
When do you get to hear a conversation like this? Well, we know it's when you listen to In the Thick, yo.
Oh!
So I really want to say a special thanks to everybody who helped to put together our series of live events in Chicago. Our thanks to DePaul University, to La Mera Mera Jefa, the department chair of the Latino and Latin American Studies Department at DePaul, Lourdes Torres. Her number one assistant, Lisa Aviles, who like does it all. Our recording engineers, Mike Lust, Blake Truska, and his audiovisual team, and our associate producer, Nicole Rothwell. What a team. Thank you for those live recordings in Chicago. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
So you got to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. Mm-hmm. This week, you're going to tell your father's side of the family to listen to us. Your entire father's side. Tell them to listen to In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook. Also, look for us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. And our producer is Stephanie LeBeau. Our associate producer is Nicole Rothwell. Futuro Media's executive director is Erica Dilde. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. The music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. We'll see you next time on In the Thick. Hasta la próxima.
Nos vemos.
Ciao.
We're going to end with one final question from the front row.
I wanted to go back to what Mr. Suavecito or Suave said.
Mr. Suavecito! Suavecito!